You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Erica Pinheiro, executive director of Al Otro Lado. On the Biden immigration record. Also on the program today, Brian Muir, correspondent for Telesur English. Writer at Brazil Wire on the recent coup attempt in Brazil. Also on the program today, debt ceiling game of chicken commences as Republicans move to take the country hostage. George Santos gets awarded two committee assignments as it's revealed he stole $3,000. From a GoFundMe to help a homeless vet's dog. New York State Senate gears up for fight with Kathy Hochul over a conservative chief judge nominee. Matt Schlapp, sued by Herschel Walker aide for sexual battery and defamation. Ukrainian cabinet member and 14 others killed in a helicopter crash outside of Kyiv. Maine governor moves to expand abortion access in that state. House Republicans looking to impeach Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas because we have a border. University of Illinois faculty strike continues. 1,500 educators staging a labor action yesterday. North Dakota House weighs book bannings for books with sexual content. And Lena Khan's chief of staff heads to the Department of Transportation to help out a completely incompetent Pete Buttigieg. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is always a special day on Wednesdays because of how this day catapulted my co-host into fame after
and
she
fortune.
Coined and,
yeah.
and fortune and yeah. after she coined the phrase that I every day, every week I hear more and more people use it.
I know. I mean, if you look, it's hump day, folks.
Thank you.
If you look up my, you know, Matt and I last week, we looked up our net worth according to those those websites, and that's how
Solved
I got.
It.
That's how I got that $500,000 fortune, and I didn't really structure the contract well for hump day because somehow Matt got like a way too big of a chunk of
it.
And
well,
that's why
gotta
he's
read the
worth
contract.
$1.5 million.
Nice couple points every time somebody says that. So.
Yeah,
that's funny because Saul the other day we were having dinner and he looks at me and goes, "What's your net worth?" And I'm like, "Excuse me." And he goes, "I know what your net worth is." And I said, first off, you don't know what net worth means. And second off, you don't know what it is because you've been searching online. And I said, I have some very bad news for you. I don't know if this was like
6'2" if someone wants to update my facts, buddy.
Yeah, it says he's 5'8", right? He got shortchanged, no pun intended.
Saul's birthday's coming up. And so I think he was getting like, he was starting to have like, his eyes are starting to like bulge.
He's trying to make a case for a big gift.
Why are people like a new shirt? No, this is my gray shirt. I have like...
It's spiffy.
Yeah. I got this when I went to the Siegfried and Roy sample sale.
Yeah.
all right. Let's get into this. You don't hear as much about Davos as I feel like we used to. They try. I think they low-key it a little bit. And if you're interested in Davos, I would go back. This is maybe 10 years now. Chris Hayes wrote an amazing piece about Davos. and really about like fractal inequality, where the millionaires at Davos get really, really upset because they don't have the key card that takes them up, literally up in the elevator to the billionaires, like a lounge area. But there's a reason why you go to Davos, and it probably changes for different people, right? But Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin are in Davos for the World Economic Forum meeting. And here is Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin, or Kristen Sinema, discussing her reasons as to why she became an independent and the filibuster fight. And when you see the way this ends in the second clip, you'll understand what they're doing there.
Senator Cruz, since last time we met, you become an independent.
That's correct.
Happened that same day or the day after, didn't it?
So, as folks know, I have formally declared my independence from what I consider to be a deeply broken two-party system. Those who know me know that I was always an independent voice and always have been for the things that I believe in and for my state and for my country. But I do think it's important to note that that what you've heard about partisanship, I believe, is accurate. You know, in the last 2 years, we think...
Pause it for 1 second. You know, and maybe I've missed it, but I would be curious as to, from an ideological perspective, for her to explain, like, what it is that is different.
Did you see the third senator up there, by the way, Sam?
Chris Coons?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Believe me.
Biden's buddy.
They're traveling around. I mean, that's the point, right?
They're auditioning. This is like a corporate donation emporium.
Exactly. And but it just shows you the hollowness of this idea about complaining about the duopoly, which, of course, we have a duopoly in this country in terms of the parties, particularly mostly on a federal and a national level, not necessarily as much on a local level, but nevertheless,
for the people in that room, it's less of a duo. It's kind of they have actual. Maybe I'm splitting hairs, but like
this is the point. This is the point. Is that it's very easy to complain about the duopoly as, you know, just simply some type of like, I got a problem with the process,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to actually articulating what your ideology is or where you stand specifically on issues. Right. Because the reason why Chris Coons is there with Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema is because when they complain about the duopoly, they are trying to protect corporate interests. Period. End of story.
And that's why, yeah. I mean, that's when they talk about discord in Washington or no one being able to agree on anything. They're like, why don't people just agree with our completely pro-wealthy, pro-corporate agenda? I mean, it's getting a little too intense on our side of the aisle. They're too extreme.
And let's also be clear, you know, if the problem solvers, which is the caucus that is supposedly made up of these types of people, was meaningful in any way, there wouldn't have been 15 votes to get McCarthy elected, and McCarthy wouldn't have had to give the store away to, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who 3-4 years ago was not only like, you know, trying to hawk loogies through AOC's mail slot in Congress, but was also doing interviews about how the Clintons were assassins. Essentially. But all right, continue.
But I do think it's important to note that what you've heard about partisanship.
I'll pause it for one more second. I'm sorry. It's ridiculous for me not to address this. We should say Kristen Sinema is, got a lead role in the prequel to Game of Thrones.
Or the Hunger Games. I mean, well, she's got the Hunger Games on top with the glasses and the Jon Snow outfit on the bottom.
She's doing live action Bo Peep.
Yeah.
She sheared a sheep for that. Yeah.
I also will say I almost forgot what she sounds like because she is the reverse of Joe Manchin, even though they serve the same function, because he has never met a camera and microphone he doesn't like, and she chooses not to speak to anybody for no accountability.
Independent voice and always have been for the things that I believe in and for my state and for my country. But I do think it's important to note that that what you've heard about partisanship, I believe, is accurate. You know, in the last 2 years, we think, you know, January 6th, which is a horrible day from 2 years ago, created, I think, concern and fear for every patriotic American across the country. But in the resulting 2 years, the Democratic Party shared a narrative that said we would not have any more free and fair elections in this country if the United States Congress didn't eliminate the filibuster and pass a massive voting rights package. As we all know, the filibuster was not eliminated. Joe and I were not interested in sacrificing that important guardrail for the institution. That massive voting rights bill was not passed through Congress. And then we had a free and fair election all across the country. And as has been noted, the outcome of that election was different than many people expected. Most election deniers lost across the country, and individuals of both political parties, some extreme, some moderate, won. So we had a free and fair election. So one could posit that the push by one political party to eliminate an important guardrail in an institution in our country may have been premature or overreaching in order to get the short-term victories they wanted. Let me fast forward to where we are today.
Okay, I'm sorry. We just have to pause it for one more second. When she says guardrail, I want people to understand what that means. That means a block on democracy. That's exactly what the filibuster is. I mean, the House has a million problems, but at the very least, it's a majority vote. If something gets passed in the House, it gets passed. It doesn't need a 60-vote threshold to get passed. In the Senate, the filibuster that she's defending so ardently there is a guardrail, yes, for the people in that room, from taxation, from paying their fair share, from the Senate's already an undemocratic institution. When it was a 50-50 split, the 50 Democrats represented 40 million more people than the 50 Republicans. On top of that, what she's defending is an extra piece of undemocracy, which blocks legislation that's more democratic directly from the House. And she's saying that to the people who want the filibuster in place, just so it's clear for people.
And we should also add that what she's talking about, this piece of legislation, was not like two votes for every one cast for a Democrat. It was a essentially a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, which had been struck down and decimated by a Supreme Court with a majority of conservative judges appointed by presidents who did not win the popular election. And a Supreme Court, mind you, that eviscerated the Voting Rights Act, despite the fact that the Senate reauthorized it like 98-2 in 2007. But continue.
We saw the House of Representatives struggle for multiple days in a row as Kevin McCarthy, dear friend of mine, had to continue conceding point after point after point to the radical right of the GOP, to a point where he's now in an unenviable position that will make it very difficult for us to meet our obligation when the debt limit fight comes up later this year. Those are just two examples of the pull that you see political parties giving in order to get everything they want.
And again, the problem solvers, which are her people, could have easily resolved that situation by coming up with a candidate, you know, where those, you know, whatever seven Republicans who are supposedly part of the problem solvers caucus could have voted for a, you know, a moderate Republican that Democrats would have voted for, her way doesn't provide any solutions. It is only, as Emma was just articulating, a way to block things from happening. And why is that valuable? Who is that valuable to? Play this next clip. You'll get a sense.
Is partisanship serving us? I would posit to you that it's not. And so while some would say that there were reluctant folks working in Congress in the last 2 years, I would actually say that that was the basis for the productivity for some incredible achievements that made a difference for the American people in the last 2 years.
We still don't agree on getting rid of the filibuster.
That's correct. Right.
Thank you. I was
high five right
high
there.
High five.
The idea that because some midterms went okay, that the threat to democracy is over is extremely unserious and really annoying.
and also it discounts the fact that just because voter suppression in 1 year can be overcome doesn't mean that there isn't a tremendous amount that it isn't inhibiting democracy. Mm-hmm. Because if Democrats have to expend more resources to deal with voter suppression, that is resources they can't put somewhere else and make gains there. But understand why they high-fived each other and why they're there with Chris Coons. They are there to make it clear and to basically announce to the wealthiest people in the world, we are on your team. What we are doing is to your benefit, and we're going to need funds.
Yep, because open for business.
In the case of Kyrsten Sinema, she's going to be running against the Democrats, and she's going to need a base of funding, and she does not get – there are no constituents. Her average contribution amount is going to be hovering somewhere around the maximum.
Yep. Yeah.
A couple of bucks lower than whatever the maximum amount that anybody can give is will be her average donation.
And it will be interesting to see what she says about voting rights when Carrie Lake is running on the other side. I mean, God forbid, I'm hoping that, you know, there's a Democrat that's able to come out of this. But Carrie Lake seems like she wants to run for that seat in the Senate. Election denier 101.
We're going to talk to Erica Pinheiro in just a moment. She's the executive director of All Otro Lado about the past couple of weeks worth of Biden immigration moves. But first, a couple of words from our sponsor. One of those is Blinkist. And Blinkist is a great app website that allows you to understand the most important things from over 5,500 nonfiction books and podcasts in about just 15 minutes. Some are 19, some are like 14, you know, somewhere around there. They have all sorts of nonfiction books ranging from stuff like, you know, relationship stuff and how-to stuff to economics. They have that Adam Tooze book about, COVID. I can't remember the name of it, but we interviewed him about it. Yes. They have, I just listened to one of Michael Pollan's. It was, This Is Your Mind on Plants. And I'm going to read How to Change Your Mind, just because I'm interested in that. That's, you know, we've been talking about the psilocybin. I can't pronounce it, so it's not going to make a difference. But it's a great opportunity. It gives you a great opportunity to check out these books that you may not be interested in really actually sitting down with for a couple of days and reading, but you're interested in the main points of them. And they have a new feature for the premium, which they call Blinkist Connect, which essentially allows you to have like a 2-for-1. You can choose a partner, a friend, I guess your kid, and basically share your membership. And so you get basically a 2-for-1, which is awesome. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You go to Blinkist.com/majority report, start your 7-day free trial, and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. Just a reminder, the Blinks come in two forms. One, like short form, summaries written, and audio. So check it out. That's Blinkist, spelled Blink, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/majority report. And now, like I say, for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You will get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Another sponsor today, last week we had an ad. I think you were, I don't know if you were here that day, Emma, but I came in and I like, one of the first things I said to Bradley in the morning was like, I had some of that, Manicura, honey, and it's nuts. It really is.
Oh, okay.
It's honey,
but it's
not nuts.
Oh, it's honey. Yeah. It's crazy. It comes from, New Zealand. They have, they're apparently a small island off of New Zealand. Bees feed on the nectar of the Manuka tree, which is like a tea tree. And, honestly, it makes honey like that is radically different than anything you've ever tasted. It is, and Manicura has bottled this. They have multiple different types of that honey, but they have ethical beekeeping practices, keeps it 100% raw. It's a super honey because it has unique antioxidants and prebiotics. It has a natural antibacterial compound called MGO that comes specifically from the nectar of this tea tree. It contains nutrients that support optimal immune and digestive health. I use the sweetener a little bit, you know, stuff like tea and coffee sometimes, but I have been squeezing it into a spoon and it's just incredibly different than any other honey I have ever tasted. It has a different consistency and it's not quite as sweet. It's almost like caramel. It's really crazy, but you can put it on anything. Manicura's Super Honey is available in a range of easy to use formats, including a squeeze bottle and a compostable honey stick. So you can eat it straight, add it to your favorite food or beverage, or put it in your kids' lunch, as their dessert. Saul likes multiple desserts a day. And if you head to manicura.com/majority, you're going to automatically get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. That's a $15 value. That's Manicura, MANUKORA.com/majority. Get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. It's called Honey with Superpowers for good reason. So get on it. Try this delicious, creamy caramel honey, and you won't look back with Manicura. And lastly, our last sponsor of the day, Aura. I've talked about them quite a bit. I'm uptight about maintaining my online security, particularly my, I don't want my ID stolen. And Aura protects you in about 7 different ways. When you put your email in there, social security number, your passwords, it will tell you immediately where, if those things are available on the dark web. That's where, you know, criminals sell stolen information, hackers sell stolen information, and it will let you know immediately whether your email, your passwords have been compromised, your social security numbers, if you have a problem with all those, you know, sites that give up your personal information. Aura sends automatic emails to them requesting removal of your info, and that reduces the number of robocalls. Aura gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries. So if you're opening up a bank account for your kid, and or they'll send you a notice. But if it's somebody else doing it, you also get that notice and you can shut it down. Aura gives you near real-time alerts, like I say, on those credit inquiries. They also have a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. They protect your devices from all sorts of like spyware and malware and viruses, so the bad guys can't break in. They help you manage what your kids can use on their devices. So you can restrict specific apps. You can set screen time limits. You can set focus time so that they do their homework instead of watching YouTube, cat videos. There's a password manager that they have, so you can access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And then maybe you have an app that does one of those things. The beauty about Aura, it does all of them. Let Aura do the hard work of keeping you safe online. If you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial with my link. You're going to be shocked at how much of your private information Aura finds exposed in those 2 weeks. Go to aura.com/majority to start your free trial. That's AURA.com, aura.com/majority. All of our links will be posted in the YouTube and podcast description and at majority.fm. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, Erica Pinheiro, she's the executive director of Alotro Lado. I'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Erica Pinheiro. She is the executive director of Alotro Lado. Erica, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So over the past couple of weeks, really basically starting with Biden's trip to Mexico, there have been a couple of changes in the administration's immigration policy. Let's start with the what happened back then. There were changes to the asylum process. Can you walk us through those?
Sure. Well, it's important to understand that Biden has really supercharged the Trump policy known as Title 42. That's a policy where they use the excuse of COVID to completely close the border to asylum seekers. So that's been in place since 2020. During that time, the majority of people seeking protection in the United States have just been stuck on the border. So there's been now Biden is saying he's going to let in a few people. Some of them are from certain countries like Venezuela, Haiti, and Cuba, but those people need to be able to afford a plane ticket, have a financial sponsor in the United States, and fill out an app, basically, to make an appointment. And others are being given very limited appointments, and they, too, have to fill out an app and wait several weeks to actually be admitted to the United States. So it doesn't, it's a little bit more open, but it's certainly doesn't reflect what the law says asylum should be, which is a universal right to protection.
Okay, so a couple of things. Like my understanding is that the both U.S. law and international law basically say that if you come to this country, you step foot in this country, and you claim you're seeking for asylum, that you are required to have some form of due process to adjudicate that claim. And what Title 42 does is basically says, we're going to bypass that thing and we're going to bump you out. And it's amazing because it seems to be the only recognition that COVID still exists in this country by the administration. And then what you were talking about, if I understand it too, is there the expansion of this parole authority, which allows for 30,000 asylum seekers a month, that can stay for up to 2 years. But again, all the processes, and this is like you say, for Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, and Nicaragua, all the processes are, there's a hurdle there in accessing these processes, but that they have narrowed the, for the asylum, for the other asylum seekers, and presumably it's other member, you know, other people basically coming from Latin America, Central America, you know, crossing the border, they have narrowed the scope of what constitutes a certain amount of a political vulnerability or personal security, which would constitute a claim for asylum. Is that the case?
Well, I think first it's important to understand that the asylum seekers coming to the border are actually from all over the world. It's not just Latin Americans. My organization, for example, helped people from over 50 countries just in this past year. And the second thing is there's no determination. There's no like predetermination of who actually qualifies for asylum. The threshold is, can you access this app? Can you fill it out? And are you lucky enough to press that button and actually get one of those coveted appointments? It really, it works kind of like Ticketmaster, right? Where there's a concert that's going to sell out. Everyone presses the button at the same time. A few people get a ticket and everyone else is left out. That's basically what the asylum system has become. So there's no like substantive determination. It's just, can you press the button fast enough?
And just give us a sense of like, you know, what asylum seekers, why they are seeking asylum broadly from your experience.
So it really varies just depending on the country that a person's from, but I can just give a couple examples. So we see right now a lot of Russians at the border who oppose the invasion of Ukraine or don't want to fight in the war. So they're here at the border trying to seek asylum in the United States. There's Venezuelans who are fleeing political persecution or you know, economic subjugation, just all different kinds of reasons. There's Iranians that we've seen. We've seen an increasing number of Iranians who are fleeing oppression by that regime. So it really just varies by country. What I can say is that the conditions at the U.S.-Mexico border are so bad for refugees that first, there's not even power in a lot of these shelters. Like, they're not going to be able to charge their phone, never mind download an app or have internet access. It's incredibly dangerous. So the majority of people have experienced some kind of crime victimization. And, you know, it's so bad that families are sending their minor children alone. And we see these stories all the time. So it's, you know, people are fleeing unimaginable horrors, but they're certainly not safe waiting on this side of the border. And definitely most of them can't wait a few weeks for an appointment.
And so the vast majority of these people, we should be clear, are in camps in Mexico.
Yeah, there's camps that have sprung up and they, you know, continue to spring up along the border. Sometimes the Mexican government will come in and clear them out and deport people back to home countries under pressure from the United States, of course. There's a variety of shelters. There's a few dozen shelters here in Tijuana. Some are run by church groups, so they're decent. And others are literally like in an abandoned building with people sleeping on the floor with rats crawling all over them. So it just varies. Just, you know, to give you a sense, there are refugees who have money, right? There's people who have resources and they're staying in hotels. They usually wait in Mexico City or a safer place before they come to the border to seek asylum. Those are the people getting the app appointments. It's not the person sleeping on the rat covered floor, you know, with a baby next to them. It's the rich person who has the means to have internet access, have a safe, warm hotel room, who's able to press the button on CBP1 and get that appointment.
Let's turn. There was another initiative, and I want to get your opinion on this, and maybe just like an overall assessment of where we're at in terms of the Biden administration, what has to happen, because it is at best mixed, and it really just sort of depends on sort of like what aspect we're looking at. Mayorkas, the DHS secretary, last week unveiled an initiative to allow immigrant workers to give them a safer legal process to report unsafe or exploitive working conditions. What can you tell us about that, and what's your perspective on that? It supposedly will defer deportation so that the threat of reporting an abusive workplace is diminished in some way.
I mean, it's definitely a positive development. It is the result of years of advocacy by immigrant labor groups. You know, we've had programs in the past where immigrants can report trafficking to DHS or labor violations. So overall, I think it is positive. Now, the real problem that needs to be addressed is the fact that a person's legal status is tied to their job, right? So even if it's safer to report violations, and even if you're not going to get deported, if you lose that job, you're probably losing your legal status as well. So you might be in this kind of limbo for a little while your case is adjudicated, but it doesn't mean that you're actually going to get status in the United States. So that problem still remains.
So give me your assessment of where the Biden administration has been up to this point overall, and what are some of the biggest asks or the most urgent asks of the administration at this point?
I think that the Biden administration has failed to articulate a positive vision of what immigration could be. Really, what I've seen over the past few years is that the right wing has dominated the news cycle and really redefined what the immigration issue is. You know, they're calling it open borders when, in fact, you know, we're ramping up Trump era policies that close the borders. It's completely unhinged from reality, but really the right wing has done a good job of swaying public opinion against refugees at the border and against immigration in general. So I think there's been, like I said, a real failure to articulate a positive vision. Just from an advocacy standpoint, we've been incredibly disappointed with the Biden administration. I've spent countless hours in stakeholder meetings trying to help, you know, create some policies that could be more humanitarian and safe and orderly. But they've really kind of kowtowed to this right-wing pressure and just become, I would say, a lot closer. The policies look a lot more like Trump than we ever expected.
Can you
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, can you just expand on that point and how asymmetrical this has been since our immigration laws are really outdated, haven't been updated in a long time, and a lot of what the movement has been on the right, with some of these like administrative measures and Biden tripling down on Title 42. Just in the zooming out a bit, you know, how outdated is this, and how much has the right had success in moving it in one direction over the past few decades?
Well, what tends to happen, even when there is some kind of movement on immigration in a positive direction, is the compromise is always border security, right? So we've seen Customs and Border Protection expand at an exponential pace over the past few decades. And really, you know, the compromise is supposed to be easier legal immigration for better border security. But we haven't seen easier legal immigration, right? That usually that part of the compromise doesn't come to fruition. And so what we've seen is just this really intense militarization of the border, this denigration of the right to seek asylum, right? And when we're talking about the law being outdated, you know, the Refugee Convention is codified in federal U.S. law. It, like, you know, Sam mentioned earlier, if you come to the border and you ask for protection, you should get due process. Those laws are not being followed at all. Mm. So, I mean, my first ask would really be follow the law that exists, and then maybe we can work from there at fixing what needs to be fixed.
What seems to be really odd to me, too, is that, you know, largely, Democrats aren't paying a price politically, it seems to me, for all the rhetoric that we hear about the open border and the craziness and the things are. I mean, the Republicans in Congress are very close to being able to sort of like move forward with attempting to impeach Mayorkas, because presumably, like, he's just, you know, he's pulled all the troops off the border as far as they're concerned, and there's nobody there, and it's just a sort of like wide open thing. And it's just a bizarre, it's a bizarre twisting of reality. Democrats don't seem to have been necessarily paying a political price in the Southwest states per se, and yet the Biden administration, you know, makes these moves that they don't. That to crack down, that they're not getting any credit for anyways. Like, I don't understand the dynamic. It's very hard to follow what the political thinking is. Is it just that they have such myopia in the administration? They just want to avoid this issue to the extent that they can, that they just, or is there any sense that there's anybody like genuinely thinking from a political standpoint? Like, you know, that like what the dynamics are at play here, because I think the best thing that could happen for immigrants is for them to try and impeach Mayorkas.
Yeah, I agree. Honestly, I mean, I think they've done a terrible job at, like I said, articulating a positive vision. This has just been, the politics have been so reactive, and, you know, they end up on the losing end. But I think what's important to remember is that border security is a bipartisan project. It always has been. I don't think there really is a right or left when it comes to border security. The point of all these policies is to keep Black and brown immigrants out of the United States. And so when you are looking from the perspective of, you know, oh, the Democrats are on the side of immigrants, it doesn't make sense. But when you understand and look back at the past few decades where both parties have increased the budget of Border Patrol, both parties have, you know, supported really oppressive policies at the border, then of course it makes sense. And I think a lot of times too, this administration is using the, you know, pressure from the right wing as an excuse to keep these policies. You know, I've seen this working directly with DHS. You know, when Title 42 is supposedly ending, they don't make any plans for it to end because they know the right wing states are going to sue and they're depending on that. And so when those, you know, decisions come down from the courts, they're like, oh no, can't get rid of Title 42, but we know that they never actually planned for the end of it. So that's the dynamic I'm really seeing. They can kind of make excuses that they're opposed to right-wing policies to keep, you know, some of the base, the pro-immigrant base kind of quiet. But in reality, I think they support those policies as well.
Erika Pinheiro, Executive Director of Otro Lado, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people get more information and support your organization?
So you can go to our website. It's alotrolado.org. And there's links to all of our social media there. And thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Brian Mir, correspondent for Telesur English and writer at Brazil Wire on January 8th, I guess. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Brian Mir. He is a correspondent for Telesur English and a writer at Brazil Wire. Brian, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Will you just give us a little bit of background? I mean, I think folks, our audience is fairly familiar with where we were on January 7th. But give us a little bit of background as to, you know, there has been really almost, I don't know, close to a decade, that has brought us to this point. Maybe closer to 8 years or something like that. But, just walk us through some of those major points so that people have an understanding of where we are. And also please include U.S. involvement in this sort of like, I guess, inciting event that brought about ultimately what we saw.
Okay, well, starting in 2014, there was a joint anti-corruption investigation between the U.S. DOJ and the a small district attorney general task force in Curitiba called Car Wash or Lava Jato. And what initially looked like a good anti-corruption investigation became weaponized and targeted against the Workers' Party, leading to illegitimate impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, and the political imprisonment of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Lula, right? And what that really did was open the door for Bolsonaro to take power. So Lula has been fully exonerated. It's recognized that he was wrongly imprisoned. After Bolsonaro was elected, he immediately appointed the judge who had ruled both on the investigation against Lula and on the actual trial itself, Sergio Moro. He made him his justice minister. And together, this is already into the Trump years now, they visited the CIA headquarters together shortly after Bolsonaro took office. And so from that point forwards, we've noticed a very strong and close relationship between a group of American far-right operatives connected to Robert Mercer, like Steve Bannon, Jason Miller, Matthew Tiermond, with a lot of free publicity from Tucker Carlson on Fox News, you know, connecting the Bolsonaro family, mainly through their son Eduardo, Jair Bolsonaro's son Eduardo, who was actually at the War Council meeting in Washington, D.C. on January 5th, you know, with this American far right. And so for the last 2 years, Jair Bolsonaro was threatening not to accept the results of the election. And they started about a year ago building this big lie style narrative, almost exactly the same to what Trump did in the United States. You know, with a few differences, because in Brazil, it's all electronic voting. So they started arguing, Bolsonaro and people from the military who are close allies of his, because he's a former military captain himself, started weaving this narrative that the elections were going to be stolen, you know? And so he appointed a military, an auditing group from the army to audit the electronic voting. And even they couldn't find any evidence of fraud, even his own committee. But he refused. He was very slow to acknowledge the results of the election. and some of his top cabinet members also refused to acknowledge the results of the election. Different from January 6th, you know, 2 days before the inauguration, Bolsonaro fled the country. He's afraid of going to jail now. I mean, he's committed so many crimes. There's over 140 impeachment requests against him that he kept buying off parts of Congress to not go through. But there are all these charges going up against him. So he fled, and they weren't strong enough to actually do this kind of thing that they did in the U.S. on Inauguration Day, because hundreds of thousands of supporters of Lula came out to see the inauguration. So they waited until a week later. This has probably been all over the news in the U.S. and stuff, but basically January is vacation month in Brazil. Brasilia itself is a city full of bureaucrats, government employees, and most of them leave the city for the entire month. Plus, it was on a Sunday, so it was an empty Sunday on the slowest month of the year, when around 10,000 of these people, who we now know were fleshed out with homeless people. Hundreds of the people they arrested turned out to be homeless people who were just getting paid to flesh out the crowd. You know, they entered these empty government buildings. And that's one of the key differences between, you know, the U.S. event and the what happened in Brazil. But basically, it's the same script. And the problem that Bolsonaro and his allies, his cronies, are running into now is that Brazil has an entirely different legal system than the United States. So they took advice from all these far-right elites from the United States, from the private sector now, who don't speak Portuguese and don't know anything about the laws down here. So a bunch of these people are already getting arrested. Bolsonaro now, he's afraid of coming back to Brazil because he would be arrested if he tried to come back into the country right now.
He'd be in the Lulag, right? That's what they're calling
exactly,
it?
The Lulag, yeah. Ironically, these people who are literally trying to implement a fascist dictatorship like the ones we had in the 70s and 80s here, where they were torturing everybody. You know, now they're trying to act like this human rights violation is going on.
There's a lot I want to get to there. In addition to the sort of like, you know, the history that has brought about a different legal system, in Brazil, and the sort of the stakes being a little bit different, than they are in the U.S. with this type of an event. But I want to just go back to the DOJ, involvement in, Lava Jato. Like, how unique, is it conceivable that in a different a parallel universe, it's helpful to have the DOJ associated with an anti-corruption investigation? How much of that indicates that the position of the United States was we would like to get rid of essentially Lula? And essentially eject the People's Party from power, essentially the Workers' Party.
Well, unfortunately, we now have, you know, 7 terabytes of hacked Telegram conversations between the prosecutors, sometimes with Judge Sergio Moro. You know, The Intercept with Glenn Greenwald, they only released a tiny amount of it, little by little, over the course of 9 months. And they waited until the COVID crisis was breaking and Glenn was already on his way out of Intercept with some other journalists that released the information about the U.S. involvement. But we know, for example, that there was a team of 18 FBI agents that was secretly outside of the terms of the actual, you know, partnership between the DOJ and the public prosecutors, which went under the ambit of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is a law that enables American FBI and DOJ to operate in other countries if it involves a company that's done business in the United States. We know that these FBI meetings were outside of the terms of that partnership contract. Every 15 days, they met with the prosecutors during the time that they were persecuting Lula, giving them advice on things like how to use coerced plea bargain testimonies, which were a new thing in Brazilian law, and how to deal with like media strategies and things like that. And in 2017, Kenneth Blanco, who was the acting assistant attorney general of the United States, gave a speech at the Atlantic Council, which you can see. I mean, me and Michael Brooks talked about this back in the day, yeah. Right? But he's bragging about, it's on YouTube still. I mean, he's bragging about how they helped arrest Lula, how they helped go after Lula. Lula had been convicted, but he wasn't in jail yet in 2017. So it looks like the U.S. was actually, you know, involved in that, which is the ironic thing now is that the Biden administration has been helping, you know. So it just shows you how crazy politics is.
That's so interesting, though, right, is that the initial involvement seemingly of the DOJ is much more consistent with United States involvement in Latin America for the past many decades. And is it fair to say that this divergence where the Biden administration is being supportive of Lula is more about domestic politics here, given the Bannon connection and the far right consistency with how Trump operated and tried to overturn the election, and how Bolsonaro used the same playbook and honestly some of the same players?
Exactly. I mean, it's ironic. 3 days after Dilma Rousseff was thrown out of office, most other countries in Latin America refused to recognize the new government. But Joe Biden met with the coup president, Michel Temer, at that time and said he had full support from the U.S. Now,
Joe Biden as vice president.
As vice president, yeah. He said, I'm giving you a message from President Obama. Now, his administration is giving a lot of support to the Lula administration. And the reason for this isn't like what some weird conspiracy Twitter people are trying to allege or something, that, you know, like Lula's a pawn now of U.S. or something. It's because Bolsonaro was so stupid that he got involved in a political battle that had nothing to do with him up in the U.S. Like, why would you take sides on something like that? He was the last world leader to recognize Biden's electoral victory. After Biden took office, the Biden administration sent down Jake Sullivan, the CIA director as well, different government officials to try and work with the Bolsonaro administration. They were still going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And at some point, they apparently just said, this is ridiculous. You know, we can't allow Bannon and, you know, whoever else, the Koch and Robert Mercer and these like neo-fascist or Sebastianist, whatever you want to call them, right-wing, you know, elites from the United States have such a big toehold in the Western Hemisphere, because Brazil's the second biggest country in population and GDP in this hemisphere. So it would just be for pure, you know, self-interest politically, it would be dumb for the Biden administration to have supported Bolsonaro, you know, or to not be supporting Lula at this moment. So it's just like this convergence. It reminds me of World War II when the Roosevelt administration did a lot of good things in Brazil, helped Brazil start a national steel industry, because at this point, the U.S. needed Brazil as an ally against Hitler and everything. It just seems like this convergence where all of a sudden, and it's not just the U.S., but like almost every government in the world is supporting Lula right now. Even neo-fascist Italy gave a solidarity statement in support of Lula. Which, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, is that because Bolsonaro is just that sort of like obnoxious? I mean, on some level, there's a weird lack of integrity from the forces within the United States that were afraid of a, you know, more socialistic, let's say, administration in Brazil because of what it might portend in terms of U.S. corporate interests there, or it might spread to other parts of Latin America. It's a weird lack of integrity to not maintain that position for more than a couple of years because, you know, you don't like because Bolsonaro is just incredibly obnoxious and hanging out with people you don't like. I mean, I'm happy for it, but it is pretty amazing that
it's crazy.
They have the ability to go against whatever these interests were 6 years ago. Now, on these grounds, it may also be a function of just how much the Steve Bannons and the Trump people have alienated themselves from those interests as well.
I mean, look, if you look at like the Cold War, the U.S. government allowed or, you know, permitted or whatever, much better labor laws and things like that than after the Cold War. And, you know, I feel like at this point, moderate social democracy, which is really all that the Lula administration ever was and all it's promising, is better than straight up fascism. And if you look back at like the history of Germany in the 30s, you see this too. At the beginning, a lot of the industrialists, bourgeois elites or whatever, they kind of supported Hitler coming to power. Mm-hmm. But then it got to this point where like, wait a second, this guy is so crazy. He's damaging our business interests.
Right.
And I think with Bolsonaro, the local business elites wanted the PT, the Workers' Party out. You know, but they're realizing now, I mean, a lot of his top allies are back in the Lula camp. They're realizing now that he was just like, it might have looked good for the first year or something, but essentially he's completely ruined Brazil's reputation internationally. Brazil had the highest per capita death rate from COVID, and there's a real serious risk to the Amazon right now. So it's just not sustainable. Like, you know, of course they would want someone more, I would say, neoliberal or something than Lula if they had a choice. But in this case, moderate social democracy is much better for the U.S., even U.S. business interests, for Brazilian businessmen, things like that, than a deranged lunatic, which is what Bolsonaro is.
How much did Bolsonaro's like COVID policies add to that sense of this guy's a lunatic?
I think a lot, especially inside Brazil, because so many people lost relatives and stuff. I mean, my wife lost 12 relatives to COVID.
Oh, jeez.
And he was telling people that the vaccine caused AIDS.
Well, I think we might be 6 months away from that, frankly, with some of the people in this country, in terms of their making that argument. I want to go back to, why they chose now. I understand. I mean, we have both, the U.S. and Russia, if I understand this, who are willing to, provide some measure of security for the inauguration. It ended up, there was, like you say, hundreds of thousands of people came out. Would have been much harder to pull off something like they did on January 8th. But why? What was the theory behind the assault when nobody's in the buildings? Like what did, if somebody's paying homeless people to do this, there's obviously, this is not like a spontaneous just sort of outpouring of angst and, you know, the election integrity concerns. I mean, I have some question too as to like what Bolsonaro's role was. I just remember like in the week or two before January 8th, we were looking at video of like, what's this dude walking around Orlando for? Like
he's in a VR headset, you know, games.
He's playing games in a VR headset. He's like walking around in like a gated community. He's getting filmed in a grocery store. I mean, it really felt to me at the time like I it just seemed incredibly strange. Like, this is not the behavior of somebody who just lost something, who wants to be like, why does he want to be seen this way? And on January 8th, I had an alternate theory as to why he wanted to be seen that way, because he wanted to be clear, like, I wasn't there, you know, and I don't know, that's speculation on my part, but I just thought it was really weird beforehand. Like, this is not the behavior of someone who lost an election and is mad about it, and they're going grocery shopping. I don't know. I found that strange. So, two-part question. Like, one, why when it was completely empty? Like, what was supposedly going to happen? Do you think they were hoping would happen at that moment? And to what extent is there evidence that Bolsonaro was aware of what was going to happen? And presumably, if he's aware of it, he may be involved in somewhat in the planning.
If he was aware of it while he was president and didn't do anything, then he's guilty of a felony administrative omission, right? But first of all of that stuff of him walking around, like he was eating KFC on the day of the event, I think that was all staged. It was all coached by the Bannon-type people, these operatives, you know, make him look like a simple man. It's a kind of fascist thing they do these days, I guess. I mean, he's a multimillionaire. And but I think the plan, as we know about it now, in part because the federal police found written plan in the house of Bolsonaro's former justice minister, who was in Orlando on the 8th. You know, he had been appointed to be justice minister of Brasilia after Lula took over, by the very right-wing governor of Brasilia. And he got the position, which immediately flew up to Orlando, Florida, too. The plan was that they thought there would be enough sympathy in the army that if they caused this big commotion, they had the military police on their side. They had the governor on their side. The military police basically just opened the doors for them. There's all these images of them taking selfies with the rioters or terrorists, whatever you want to call them, taking selfies and things like that. They were all on the side. So the plan was that Lula would panic and declare a state of emergency. And this would allow the military, the army, to come in. And the army would, in their minds, switch sides and just take over the government. And there would be a military coup.
Something like, we need to have a new election because there's clearly some problems here, or we need to, you know, Bolsonaro, we need to bring back his acting president and for just a year, and then we'll figure stuff out. One of those type of things.
Exactly. And it's similar to what one of Trump's advisors was suggesting that he do in December 2020, actually. You know,
yep.
It makes me wonder if there was any...
Wonder where he got that from, well, right?
Exactly.
You made the point that the legal system is different in Brazil. One of the things that I have seen, and it's no secret that that Glenn Greenwald, you mentioned The Intercept and him getting the Lavajato a hack essentially. And there's been some questions, and you've written about, you know, the question surrounding why only certain aspects of this leak was sort of published, and that the hacker himself was sort of disappointed that Greenwald, in the way that Greenwald released things and how much of it he released things. And so, one of my sources for what's going on in Brazil is Glenn Greenwald in English as opposed to in Portuguese. He has been suddenly sounding the alarm of authoritarianism in Brazil and speaking about what's happening in Brazil in the same way you would about the United States, but there is no First Amendment in Brazil. In the same way, like there's no First Amendment in England. Like the democracy, the structure of democracy within the context of Brazil is constructed in a very different way than it is in the United States. There's more than one way to approach this. And when you talk about judges there who are overreaching, they may look like they're overreaching from the context of a U.S. Perspective, but from a Brazilian perspective, they have a different function. And that, will you walk us through that, and also how those differences in the legal system and the structure of democracy in Brazil made the calculations of what would happen different than what would have happened in the United States?
Yeah, first of all, Brazil has, they're using, in a very American style, it's not just Greenwald, but it's other people like Matthew Tyrmand and other people affiliated with Fox and with Tucker Carlson. They're weaving this narrative of this one judge, and it's very convenient for them because he's bald and he looks a little bit like Dr. Evil or something like that, or Lex Luthor. You know, so they're making him out to be this supervillain, like this Bond villain who's engaged in overreach or something like that. What it really is that Brazil has an electoral court system that was established in 1932 that oversees all of the elements of the elections, from the tallying of the votes to creating the laws regarding campaign financing, election fraud, and enforcing the laws. So they've always had the ability to order arrests of people for committing election fraud. And so what's happening is that Greenwald and others, they're concentrating the entire system. It's one of the elements of the Brazilian rule of law, and they're treating it as if it's this one person. And it's not this court system that's making its own investigations and collective decisions, and he's just the president of that court right now. He's a supreme, because the president is always also a Supreme Court justice. So he's a Supreme Court justice, and he was appointed president for like a two-year term of the Superior Electoral Court. So he's just doing his job. After the elections in 2018, the electoral courts ruled that all kinds of fraud had been committed on social media. They didn't exercise their power to completely cancel the election of Bolsonaro, which they could have, but they said, we're going to guarantee that it doesn't happen again. And so when the election cycle started, remembering in 2018, for example, the Bolsonaro people used big data targeting to bombard evangelical Christians with false information that the presidential candidate Fernando Haddad was a pedophile and things like that. I mean, that's illegal in Brazil. It's illegal to do these kinds of things because, segueing into the legal element, there was a brutal dictatorship. Brazil was the country that had the largest Nazi party outside of Europe in the 1930s. And there was an associated fascist movement called Integralism that was much, much larger, that held an attempted coup d'etat in 1937. And a lot of their ideals permeated the brutal military dictatorship that we had down here from 1964 to 1985. So when Brazil finally got to write a new constitution in 1988, they took a lot of influence from the German constitution on how they deal with Nazism and far-right groups and things like that. And so instead of this 220-year-old concept of free speech absolutism or something, the way it's interpreted in the U.S. Constitution, they have a concept called the harmony of rights. All human rights are important, but one human right can't be used at the expense of another human right. Mm. So, for example, you don't have the freedom of speech in Brazil to argue that Jews should be exterminated, or that, you know, you can't publish an article saying gay people are trying to exterminate the human race or something, because that incites violence against another group of people, and they have a right to live their lives in peace, right? And in that sense, actually being belonging to a Nazi party or even saying that you support Nazism is also a crime in Brazil. And so when this blogger, this YouTuber guy, said on the air that he thought Brazil should have its own Nazi party, he was fired. And then Glenn stepped in and helped get the guy get a new job. And now this guy, on the day of the coup attempt, he was cheerleading for them. And so the electoral courts canceled his social media accounts, or temporarily, for now, pending investigation. That's totally legal in Brazil. The idea of importing the United States conception of any law into another legal setting is imperialist. You know, it's like, it's not, it's just an imperialist thing to do. And I feel like the big tech billionaires are in on this idea of exporting the US vision of free speech absolutism, because it helps reduce their liability in other countries.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And
so I feel like it's an entire campaign. It's not just like Glenn Greenwald or something like that. Because then you immediately have like Elon Musk agreeing with him.
I think they're doing a similar thing here. And we should also say, like, the maximalist view of the First Amendment, that is also not necessarily the tradition in this country. I mean, the saying, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, has been problematically applied, within this country in ways that have inhibited leftists because they're undermining, U.S. war efforts at times or whatever it is. But that as a doctrine, it does make some sense, and both in the context of U.S. law, but also in terms of like respecting other people's rights. If you walk up to me with a gun, because you have a Second Amendment right and you put it in my face, that could inhibit my free speech. And so, theoretically, it's impossible to escape this balance of things. And Brazil has has edified that concept legally, far more than we have adopted it here. But again, I mean, your point's made. And so, with that said, in terms of like assessing the response by Brazil's sort of elite or whatever the terms are rebanding around, and I have no doubt that this is not just Glenn Greenwald, this is not just a single voice. There is a concerted effort, obviously, to impose a perspective on Brazil. I think it's happening in the U.S. too, but in Brazil, it's that much more of divergent from what the structure of the system is. What was it that they miscalculated in terms of like Lula's response or the system's response based upon the legal system there that inhibited their planned coup?
Well, Lula is one of the most, as Michael Brooks probably said dozens of times on this program, Lula is one of the most clever and savvy politicians, anywhere. And he kind of had a feeling that might be what they were doing. So what he did, so first we had this situation where people were running amok in the government buildings, taking a crap on filming themselves taking a crap on someone's desk or something and streaming on the internet.
They also took that from us. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I pointed it out to show the similarities, right? Yeah. Like, it's just imported. That's not part of Brazilian culture. Brazilian, that's not an element of Brazilian culture to do that kind of thing,
I'm not sure it's part American, of American really, culture either, to be honest with you, but maybe.
It's definitely more American.
It's not like typical American behavior. Let's say that. Let's put it that way. but basically, Lula was like, so first the governor was like, oh, my security secretary, he's left the country. It's his fault. He's fired because the governor is a staunch Bolsonaro ally. So he was trying to protect his hide. But then Lula gave the governor like another hour and a half to try and solve the problem. And when it was still going on 3 hours into it, he issued a decree saying, well, that's that. The governor's lost control of the security apparatus in Brasilia. Federal government's moving in. And in 20 minutes, and they issued an arrest warrant for the former security director of Brasilia, who was with Bolsonaro in Florida. Within 20 minutes, all three buildings were completely cleared out by federal police and civil police, just showing how easy it would have been for the military police to have stopped them, right? Most of the people there were over the age of 50. It was a lot of like angry white Brazilians in their 60s and stuff. I mean, it wasn't like, but they're infiltrated within that group were people who were like, knew exactly where to go, who broke into the intelligence agency, stole all of their weapons and things like that. So it was coordinated. But anyway, within 20 minutes, it's cleared out without needing the military. So the base commander in Brasilia had 2,500 troops mobilized, saying, oh, yeah, we're ready to help out. But he seems like one of these rogue military guys who was like really hoping there would be a coup. And so he wasn't called on. They weren't authorized to act. So I thought that was a very clever move. And now,
so Lula preempted the opportunity for the military to get in and control the situation, essentially.
He knows how the military thinks. He's one of the people who helped bring down the first military dictatorship.
Mm, right.
Yeah. His brother was brutally tortured during the dictatorship. He was arrested by them. So he understands their way of thinking. That's why I think he did what he did.
And just returning to Bolsonaro for a second, if he's hiding out in the United States, right, there's been dozens of Democratic lawmakers who have implored the Biden administration and Blinken to force him out of the United States and send him back to Brazil. And basically, Blinken's response has been, well, once he gets charged, we will, you know, extradite him like any other private citizen, essentially. But what's your read on that? It seems like now that he has these new buddies, he is trying to get a safe haven within an American context where he might be a little less culpable or be able to be a free man, where Lula, is it in him and in his interest to use some of the laws that you described to bring charges against Bolsonaro?
Well, the justice minister, Flavio Dino, he just requested that the courts include Bolsonaro in the investigation into the coup attempt. So Bolsonaro is officially under investigation right now. And he's a suspect in all kinds of other crimes. In fact, the federal police were planning on bringing him in for questioning on January 1st for his comments about the vaccine causing AIDS or turning people into alligators or helping women grow beards, which was ruled in an investigation in Congress to have, you know, exacerbated the number of deaths in the country. So he's got charges against him for a bunch of things. And I bet they'll just go through the regular procedures and file an extradition request at some point. But it would be nice if the State Department always denies people visas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're always like denying people from Brazil who want to take vacation in the U.S., just not giving them their visas for whatever reason. It seems almost arbitrary sometimes. Because, you know, why can't they just, he's been given 30 days for a change of status because he got in on a diplomatic visa. And now it looks like some businessmen in Florida who are Brazilian are trying to hire him as a public speaker for Brazilian events so that he can get some kind of work visa or something. I mean, I don't see why they couldn't just deny his request for change of status. You know, I think that's what these members of Congress are kind of suggesting. And I just want to say that at the height of Lava Jato and everything, when the DOJ was working with, the people in Curitiba to take down the Workers' Party, there's a group of around 12 to 25, varying in numbers, members of Congress who always stood in solidarity with Dilma Rousseff and Lula, a lot because of the labor unions. The AFL-CIO never gave up on them, always pressuring their lawmakers to stand in solidarity. And these are people like Hank Johnson, you know, Rocana, Raul Grijalva, Susan Wild, you know, and they've been doing some fantastic work. I just think it's worth recognizing that what's happening with U.S. government support right now isn't entirely because of like opportunism or electoral self-interest on the part of the Democratic Party. There are some people, Ilhan Omar is another one.
Bernie, you know, in the Senate, too, right, had that resolution.
Also, yeah, of course. Yeah. Bernie, the whole time. Never bought into that Lula's corrupt narrative.
Well, Brian Mier, really appreciate your time today. We'll catch back up with you and see where these develops. But really appreciate your sort of explaining this entire sort of episode to us. People can see you on Telesur English and read you at Brazil Wire. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And also right on Left Reckoning last week, right? Yep. You could check that out.
Yep. Thanks, Brian.
Look at me.
The Matt Leck Media Universe.
Yep.
Yes.
Damn. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks so much, Brian.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. The number will be 646-257-3920 today. That's the number we're going to be answering today. Just a reminder to your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. AM Quickie is moving to a paid subscription model, or at least for part of it. So you get a little bit of it every week, but if you want all of it, sign up So we can, at the very least, support it. Yesterday was the first paid edition. People are loving it. You can sign up for it at amquickie.com, or you can do it through the app. The app is completely free, majorityapp.com. It's got all the links. You can, if you become a member, you can IM us. You know, remember, it is your memberships that allow the show to survive and thrive. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. And on Sunday night, blessedly, there is no Giants game. Emma and I are going to be joining, Matt and, Griscom from, Left Reckoning and, the guys from, This Is Revolution, or at least, Jason and, Ben Burgess, at the Cutting Room, which is like a 30, and Bhaskar is going to be there, 32nd Street. I don't know, somewhere in Midtown, 32nd Street.
The cutting room.
Oh, there it is.
It's like right in the middle.
44 East 32nd Street, right next to the Empire State Building, or near enough there. Still tickets available this Sunday night. For Em and Sam joining the This Is Revolution, Jason, and Give Them Argument, Ben Burgess, and me and Griscom.
It's going to be fun, folks. Check it out. Emma, what's happening on... today's not Thursday. Mm. What's happening on ESVN?
Yesterday was a very fun episode. We did a breakdown of every game over Wild Card Weekend. I went kind of nuts talking about the Giants. Also,
what were you drinking?
I had a High Noon, yeah. I tried a new flavor, passion fruit. They're like, they're like beers, passion, but it's just a hard seltzer.
Passion being the operative word.
Yes, I was. Exactly. It was in the spirit. And, you know, we also just talked about some of the recent firings of offensive coordinators, Byron Leftwich, Joe Lombardi. Especially Joe Lombardi deserved it, but being scapegoated for terrible performances by their head coaches, among other things. On Thursday, I wanted to talk about Provorov, the Philadelphia Flyers defenseman who refused to wear the Pride warm-up jersey for the NHL, despite it being in his contract, citing religious obligations and just being a bigot. We'll talk about that on Thursday, among other things, youtube.com/ESVN show.
Matt.
Oh, yeah. Last night, in addition to the live show this Sunday, I talked to Robert Skvarla about the church committee, why we shouldn't maybe expect Jim Jordan to be the next Frank Church, and a little bit of JFK stuff.
What? So, what? Yeah. Seriously?
Not quite the same sort of pedigree, if you can believe it.
Honestly, like, this is why I have a problem with referring to it as the new church committee. Because it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even structured that way. It's not even like its mission is not even that.
It's closer to HUAC.
Yes, right.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah.
Honestly. And that is like, you know, like I am certainly open to the possibility that Jim Jordan will be concerned at rooting out, like, you know, spying on Muslims and, you know, trading of information between the NSA and the FBI and the CIA. And
he's finally ready to fight institutional corruption.
Yeah. And you know, the idea of like buying information that they wouldn't otherwise be able to secure in terms of like spying on us. I'm really looking forward to that Jim Jordan effort. But I think like calling it the new church committee sort of like it's a little bit early to refer to it that way. But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's it. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. But yeah, go check out my discussion with Robert.
Folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back, back. back. Just want to degrade the white man. Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy, 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 pussy.